I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In September 2014, the Harper government finalized the Canada-China Foreign Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement. A new book sounds the alarm about the agreement and how it favors China, not Canada, and how it puts our democratic institutions at risk. The book's author, Gus Van Harten, joins me now. In the book, he discusses how the agreement was rushed and how its long-term effects haven't been fully comprehended. The book is called Sold Down the Yangtze, Canada's Lopsided Investment Deal with China. I'll get him to tell us about how this agreement is flawed and how it's the trend globally, and I'll get him to reflect on what might happen and what the citizen might consider this fall, what with the federal election. Gus Van Harten is a professor at Osgoode Hall Law School. He's taught previously at the London School of Economics. He's a frequent commentator in the media. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program from Burlington, Ontario, Gus Van Harten. Professor Van Harten, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for joining us. So some people who've doubtless heard from you or read you in the last few years have known you to be a critic of this deal. So let's get it out of the way. Are you against trade or just this deal?
No, I'm not against trade. People are sometimes accused of being against trade or free trade, which I liken to being accused of being against, say, breathing. People have been trading with each other for thousands of years, and it's a pretty ridiculous smear. My criticisms are directed at the little-known but extraordinarily important parts of the so-called trade agreements that deal with the protection of foreign investors. So I'm a general critic of those clauses, and I was particularly concerned about the investment deal with China because it took that clause, that mechanism, to a new level and was lopsided in quite surprising ways in favor of China.
Now, is this something, because the Harper government has talked about, and doubtless will talk about in this campaign, all these trade deals that they've signed with various countries, with the European Union and the sort. This protection of foreign investors, is this something that has been extended to China in this deal that other jurisdictions, say, have not been afforded?
Well, Canada only accepted these foreign investor protection mechanisms up until the Harper government in NAFTA. So 20 years ago, we did it with the United States. That is in a situation when we really faced risks and constraints in association with it. Like, we've done similar deals with small countries where it doesn't really pose a threat to Canadian democracy, Canadian budgets, and so on. NAFTA does, but in defense of the government then, companies and their lawyers hadn't really taken advantage of these mechanisms then. The foreign investors, big companies, usually very wealthy individuals, have started using the mechanisms in a big way in about the last 10, 15 years. So it's very troubling that the federal government now is expanding our exposure dramatically in the investment deal with China and a couple of other trade deals that the Harper government's pursuing. One is called the CETA and one is called the TPP. So that's a little bit of the story of Canada exposing itself to these mechanisms. And by the way, Canada is the only Western developed country ever to have accepted this foreign investor protection system with the United States. And we've had that dubious honor for, 20 years, and now we seem to be, again, extending our role as a kind of world leader and giving up our sovereignty and reducing our democratic rights in this way. It's a big deal, but there are a lot of confusing acronyms, and I think that's by design. It's to make it difficult for people to really figure out what's going on until it's too late and the deals have been locked in.
I remember about 10 years ago, or less than that, since Mr. Harper took office, he used to talk tough about China, and then I guess he was rebuffed by the regime there. He's since softened his stand, and you articulate that in your book here. How has his own rhetoric evolved, and And do you think that how this deal has come about, the FIPA, that it was in response to say those initial rebuffs that he got from the Chinese government then?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say what's going on in the Prime Minister's mind. The rhetoric certainly doesn't track what's written in the legal texts on paper, especially since the Harper government got its majority in the spring of 2011. That's when they began to move with speed to finalize, negotiate, and then eventually finalize this investment deal with China, which is lopsided in quite amazing ways. And even then, you still see rhetoric about how the government's, you know, going to take a tough stand with China, going to pressure China to give more market access to Canadian companies in China. Well, I just find all that to be, you know, kind of black humor, because the investment deal with China actually gave up market access rights in general to Chinese investors in Canada, but without getting the same general right for Canadian investors in China. And that's one of the things that makes it so remarkably lopsided. I'd never seen that before in an investment deal. They're usually equal or reciprocal in that aspect. So the government, on the one hand, is saying, well, we're fighting for market access rights for Canadian companies in China. When you look at the legal text, they have actually given it up in a very lopsided way. Rhetoric is one thing. One of the great benefits of studying legal agreements is you actually get closer to the truth of what's happening, because it's written on paper, and the officials negotiating these treaties are being very careful to be exact about what each country is actually doing. So you can learn a lot by studying them, if you have the time.
Yeah, which you do, and you're compelled enough to write this book, and which I'll talk to you about why you wrote the book in a sec. But in terms of this reciprocity over market access, why do you think this particular concession from the Harper government, and how do you think they explain that, if at all?
This is one of several concessions they made. Their response, when I've tried to point this out, is essentially to ignore it, not comment on it, or they'll kind of just try to distract from the issue by pointing to some other aspect of the treaty. But, you know, the part that really needs to be explained is why Canada would make such exceptional concessions on market access. There are others on investment screening. There's also expanded allowances for secrecy under the treaty. Chinese investors can take advantage of the treaty to bring claims against Canada for compensation that can run into vast amounts of money, billions of dollars potentially, if we pass laws, regulations, make decisions that they object to. But the government kept for itself a right in the treaty to keep all the documents confidential, except for a final award, meaning they can settle the claim, and keep in mind it may be politically very embarrassing, without anyone ever knowing that the claim existed, because you could settle the case, never get a final award, keep all the other documents confidential. So why did the government, you know, go to those lengths? I don't know, because I can't go inside their minds. It's a question they need to answer. But I have a few possible explanations I explore in the book. I can talk a little bit more about them if you like.
Yeah, yeah. We'll speculate, if you will, then.
One is it's linked to ideology. Another, it's just a lack of competence. Another is, of course, the interests that are involved. So, you know, you've got the three I's, ideology, incompetence, and interests. But I don't think any of them really could explain to me fully why the federal government would go so far in making concessions to China. And so the explanation, after I looked at the media record and that when the treaty was being negotiated, that came to me was perhaps the most likely explanation has to do with the oil sands.
Mm-hmm.
and that the government around the time they started, really kick-started negotiations of the treaty and then finalized it, you know, kind of in 2012. That was a time the oil industry was really almost desperate to look for a new market, especially for oil sands oil, because the U.S. market was looking a little less reliable. And, of course, China offers a very big market, potentially, for Canadian oil sands oil and also a source of money to invest in the infrastructure here and take a partial stake in that infrastructure. And I think maybe beyond the immediate deal itself, there was some kind of exchange where China demands that Canada give it this long-term lopsided legal deal for our whole investment and economic relationship. And in exchange, China says, well, you know, we'll be more willing to buy Canadian oil and, you know, of course, we'll want our stake in the infrastructure. I think that probably a significant part of why the government rushed to do a deal that, when you look at the terms in detail, you find they did make a lot of concessions to China.
And so in terms of the oil sands developments here in this country today, how much of that is controlled by the Chinese, say?
A significant part of the assets will be owned by the Chinese. Right now it would be, you know, somewhere between $10-15 billion, which is a relatively small share. But if you actually have to, it gets a little bit technical, but if you have an asset in Canada, so you have a pipeline, mm-hmm. or, you know, some kind of refinery, some kind of facility, they'll often have partial Chinese ownership. Okay, so even if it's a small minority stake, that asset, if the government tries to regulate it, will still qualify as Chinese. So the Chinese only have to own 5% of an asset, say the proposed Northern Gateway pipeline, and they do own at least a minority stake in that proposed project. And right there, you're talking about a Chinese-owned asset. So that means if the pipeline is regulated in a way that it doesn't go ahead for some reason, then the Chinese investors will be able to bring a claim for compensation. They won't automatically win, but in many circumstances, they'll have a reasonable chance of winning, and they would be entitled to compensation not only for what they've invested, but more importantly, what their reasonably expected profits would have been had the project gone ahead. And that's the key dilemma for governments is, do you be careful with public money, or do you remain true to your commitments to voters, your commitments to your people to make the right decisions? If the decision is we don't want a pipeline to go ahead, well, all of a sudden this FIPA with China puts a new price tag on that decision. And it could be a very big price tag, which gives a lot of bargaining power to the Chinese companies. But that's one of the essential parts of the danger here for public budgets and really for our democratic, our ability to make democratic choices.
Now, these claims, they go before who?
Yeah, so this gets pretty technical, but they go before a tribunal of three arbitrators. Arbitrators are lawyers, and they, you know, some like to describe them as judges, but they're certainly not judges because they operate in a process that creates a lot of conflicts of interest that would not be present for judges. And one of the criticisms of the Foreign Investment Protection System that I've made for a number of years is that it should be, at the very least, a judicial process, because otherwise the lawyers who make these decisions appear to be dependent on the foreign investors for their own income, because the foreign investors don't bring claims, and only the foreign investors can bring claims under these treaties. The countries can't bring claims. Well, then the lawyers aren't going to get appointments, and they're not going to get lucrative remuneration for sitting as arbitrators. So those arbitrators would then decide, there'd be three of them, they would decide if compensation should be paid to the foreign investor. And they have, I think your ordinary member of the public, it will be mind-boggling how much power this tribunal of lawyers has to redirect public money to companies and to very wealthy individuals who are the ones who typically are qualifying and bringing claims as foreign investors. In the last few years, these these arbitrators have ordered literally billions of dollars to be paid in single cases by a country, not Canada yet, but the risk is always going to be there as long as the FIPA is in place, and that just changes the bargaining dynamics when our country wants to do things that Chinese investors don't want.
And how long are we locked into FIPA?
Depressingly, this investment deal has a longer lock-in period than virtually any other investment deal Canada's ever concluded. It is a 15-year minimum term, plus 1 year's notice after that to terminate, plus another 15-year so-called survival clause. So existing Chinese investments at the time of termination would still be protected for another 15 years. That's why I describe it as a 31-year deal. Highly anti-democratic. Other treaties in international law not like this. Only foreign investors get these kind of locked-in, you know, superpowers in international law to hold countries, bring countries to heel. And that said, I don't want to leave on a, I don't want to be too gloom and doom. There are a lot of things that can still be done by governments in Canada, and I talk about them in the book. The last chapter is kind of a program for, or a platform for what, future governments could commit to do to limit the damage.
Yeah, and in talking about those things that could mitigate, say, the damage of this agreement, do you see, say, the public having, the citizen, I should say, having a bigger role in future deals, perhaps, and what might the voter be considering come this fall with the election?
Well, the public can and should play a much greater role. But first of all, the public should be properly informed before the country gets locked in. And the only way to do that is to have a full public, thorough review of the deal, to inform decision makers at all levels, to allow for a proper informed debate. Unfortunately, the FIPA, some of the other trade deals that are in the works, are almost, it seems to me, they're being rushed through precisely to prevent that kind of awareness and debate. And that should be troubling in itself, because if someone's trying to push someone through before the public becomes aware of it, well, you know, it's pretty obvious why you would want to do that. So as for the election in the fall, I mean, I wrote the book mainly, I actually felt a sense of obligation because I'm an academic. The public pays a lot of the cost of allowing me to be an academic, and I thought the least I can do is try to explain what's going on in this sort of technical and specialized field that is of great concern to voters, taxpayers, Canadian businesses, workers, and so on. And I tried to do it before the next election, because if people learn more about this treaty and are as concerned as I am about it, then the immediate decision is how to respond in the upcoming federal election. And I don't want to tell people how to vote. I would just say to try to vote for the political party or candidate who you think is going to take these issues seriously, and commit to doing some of the things that we all think are important to protect our country. So, I mean, but the one thing I will highlight is that clearly the Harper government has done an absolutely terrible job on this treaty.
Yeah, and of the other parties, the NDP, the Liberals, and, say, the Green Party, are they contrasting in terms of their attitudes towards, say, treaty making with the Harper government, say?
Yes, there are definite contrasts. Sometimes people say they're all the same. Mm-hmm. They're definitely not all the same on this issue. The Greens and the NDP came out against the FIPA, uh-huh, and they have had positions against these foreign investment protection systems that you know, really is a threat to our democracy and our budgets and so on. The Liberals have been more in the middle. They kind of tend to say, well, we don't like the deal, but we're not going to oppose it outright. I think had the Liberals been in power, we probably wouldn't have ended up with this FIPA.
Mm-hmm.
I think Harper government appeared to wait until they had a majority to move with it. I'm as surprised as the next person why on earth the Conservatives would want to do a lopsided deal with China. It flies in the face, completely flies in the face of the rhetoric. So I tend to say we should be forgetting about the Conservatives and vote for whoever you think will deliver a representative who's not conservative in your riding. I mean, I live in Burlington, so there aren't a lot of options to defeat the Conservatives based on the history here. But look, I don't really want to tell people how to vote.
Sure.
People have to vote the way they can. I'm just trying to make clear to people in as much detail and as accessibly as I can what the Harper government actually did with this deal with China.
Now, you also in the book take to task various cheerleaders in the media that came out for the deal, namely Andrew Coyne and John Iveson in the National Post. What was their part in the deal? And I guess the media hasn't done a good job in highlighting the implications of it.
Well, they wrote opinion articles that were published in the National Post, and at least in Andrew Coyne's case, in newspapers around the country, which were just full of inaccuracies about the FIPA. So they, wittingly or not, misled people about what the FIPA actually means. And as a result, as I say in the book, they were helping to lead a blind rush to lock our country in to a long-term deal without joining critics like me who were saying, let's slow down, let's have a proper public, thorough, independent review of what's being said about this FIPA so we can sort out fact from fiction and so that there can be an informed decision by the government based on what the public really would want. That was a role that they played. They weren't alone, but they played just a deeply unfortunate role. And they got what they wanted because the FIPA is now locked in. There was never what I would say, as I said, a thorough public independent review of it, and they should be remembered for what they got wrong, in my view.
And has in terms of the media's coverage of trade deals like this and the other ones that the Harper government has concluded in its years in office, do you think we as the citizen are getting, say, good information from them?
There are some journalists who really did do a good job to try to come to terms with the FIPA. I talk to a lot of journalists, and it's a hard topic to get at. It's technical, it's complex. You're taking time to look at it, talk to me about it now. But imagine trying to do it when you've got 1 minute on a television news show. It's not easy to distill. But some journalists did a good job, and some journalists just did the opposite. But I think the main issue is, I don't know why, but the major media in the country are not giving this issue the attention it deserves. This is an issue of such importance to our country. It should be in the news, often on the front pages, regularly. As I said, we did this in NAFTA 20 years ago before we really knew how dangerous these mechanisms are. And now the Harper government's rushing through three more deals, and the FIPA was like strike one. And the next two are the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and the CETA. And, there are things in those treaties that are okay and positive, but the foreign investment protection provisions have generated a great deal of controversy in the United States and in Europe. They should be stripped from those treaties. It really is an extraordinarily dubious argument to say we need mechanisms, and we have countries with mature democracies and established courts and so on. And for some reason in Canada, the major media, are not giving it anywhere near the attention it deserves.
And do you think the media is reflecting where the public is, perhaps? I mean, we remember, some of us are old enough to remember the 1988 federal election when free trade, consumed that campaign. In recent years, we've had protests against the WTO, we've had Occupy Wall Street, Some attention, I guess, paid in that sector, but in terms of trade in Canada, I mean, trade between Canada and other countries, maybe there isn't an interest, perhaps.
Well, when I have spoken about the FIPPA, when I've had access to media, sometimes social media, sometimes smaller online newspapers, the public's reactions have been overwhelming, overwhelmingly supportive of the criticism and opposition. I mean, the FIPPA was not covered by major media very much, and yet there were tens of thousands of people writing to their MPs, writing to the federal government's environmental assessment processes back in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And people were emailing me. I mean, I was very encouraged and overwhelmed by the support that came without it being in the major media. So if it were in the major media, and that's a kind of sample and indicator, this would have been a subject of great national debate. And by the way, the issues now have gone well beyond what was debated in the 1980s, because the free trade agreement with the United States didn't even have one of these foreign investor protection systems.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the people who has given me an endorsement for my book is one of the negotiators of the free trade agreement in the 1980s, Gordon Ritchie. And he talks about how it was only in NAFTA later that these provisions that give rights to foreign investors not enjoyed by Canadians themselves, that was started with NAFTA. And now it's being repeated. It's going to be quadrupled for Canada after we've learned that the lawyers are prepared to order billions of dollars in compensation to foreign investors. This is not an insignificant development. This has happened the last few years, and it's deeply troubling and worrying. That should be the subject of careful review and attempts to inform the public so that they understand just how much is being given away in democracy, sovereignty, and just our public budgets, the risks that are being posed to them. In these new foreign investor protection deals. It's like, if put it this way, if it wasn't called a free trade agreement and it was called instead an agreement to transfer public money to foreign companies, lawyers, and arbitrators, would people be more interested? I think they probably would. Free trade is just a label.
Yeah. Well, your book has done a good job in sounding the alarm, and I hope it continues to do well for you. Good luck with the book, and thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks a lot for talking to me, and it's been a pleasure.
The book is called Sold Down the Yangtze, Canada's Lopsided Investment Deal with China. You can get that you can get it online, of course, and if you're like me and want to buy your books from a bookstore, ask your local bookstore to carry it. It's author Gus Van Harten joined me on the line from Burlington, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.